Okay, everyone, welcome. We have managed to crack through the mystifying technology of our chairs, and they are now all working. So we will call the meeting to order and start with the Pledge of Allegiance. Okay. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation, under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. Amen. Okay, may we have the roll call, please?
Good evening, Commissioners. I'll take the roll call. Chair Hartwig?
I am here.
Vice Chair Hurd, I understand.
She's excused.
Thank you. Commissioner Castillo?
Present.
Commissioner Griggs Murphy?
Present.
Commissioner Montgomery?
Here.
Commissioner Griffith?
Present.
Commissioner Jung Lee?
Present.
Thank you.
Okay, do we have a motion to approve the last meeting's minutes?
So moved.
I'll second it.
Seconded. All those in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Carries unanimously. All right. Looking at old or unfinished business,
we have none.
Do we have any modifications to the agenda? Okay, I have none. Hearing none, we're moving on to new business, to item A.
Item A is a presentation to the HERS Breast Cancer Foundation of donated funds raised through the Oakland Housing Authority Police Department's Pink Patch Project. And this was hosted by the foundation. I'd like Casey Mooningham to come on up, if you will, to guide us through the presentation. Casey Mooningham is actually president of the Oakland Housing Authority Foundation's Board of Directors.
Good evening. Again, I'm Casey Mooningham.
Casey, if you can speak into the mic so they can, and if there's, we have a portable one, you need it.
So good evening. I'm Casey Mooningham. I'm the chair of the Oakland Housing Authority Foundation. And as I've said before, I believe everyone in this world has been touched in one way or another by breast cancer or any form of cancer. And so I would just ask everyone to take a moment of silence to honor those that have suffered or passed from cancer. Thank you. So we're here tonight to present a check in the amount of $4,000 to the HERS Breast Cancer Foundation. As many of you know, the Oakland Housing Authority Police Department participated in the Pink Patch Project this year. And so what we did was we bought and wore pink patches on our uniforms during Breast Cancer Awareness Month, and we had officers carry those pink patches with them on duty, off duty, and really promote breast cancer awareness, and sell the patches to raise money. What we did was once the project ended, we searched for a charity, a foundation, someone to give this money to. And we found just a wonderful foundation. And I'm just going to talk briefly about what and who they are and what they do. And then I'll invite their executive director up to say a few words. So what the HERS Breast Cancer Foundation does is they raise money to provide services and products and so forth to all women who have been, you know, either gone through some surgery or some kind of, procedure. So post-cancer, and they provide services and products for those women. They're locally based, so they're out of Fremont and Pleasanton. And we just, rather than the traditional charities or, research, those types of foundations, we decided to do something a little bit different, and it's kind of close to home for us. So without further ado, I want to invite Tina Steckler, who is the executive director, up to accept this check and to say a few words.
Thank you, Casey, very much. It's a really kind introduction. This is really an honor to accept this check. First of all, I have to say I'm really grateful that the foundation chose us, really grateful for the officers and all of your hard work to sell the patches and raise these funds. I am very much biased. I have great respect for law enforcement. My husband is retired Chief of Police Craig Steckler out of Fremont. My daughter is actually, she's 20 and she's a Lance Corporal in the Marine Corps. She's a military police, excuse me. So anyway, back to your efforts. This is tremendously supportive of our mission, and that is to provide all individuals, regardless of ability to pay, with services and products post-surgery. So I've been executive director for a very short time, just since November, but in that short time, I see really every day that we have clients come in and we provide them with really a whole spectrum of services, emotional support, and then fitting them with bras and prosthesis and lymphedema garments as well, and wigs. Many of them are in different stages of surviving and healing, and so these funds will go towards those individuals that are underinsured, uninsured, and low income, and they don't have the ability to pay. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Really appreciate this.
Do you want to come around?
Sure.
Can we get a picture for the...
Shall we go down?
Yeah.
So, Tina, you're going to take this actual check, very similar to what Happy Gilmore does, and you're going to try and cash it at the bank.
Thank you, and also thank you to all the officers for their work in selling these patches. It was kind of an incredible effort. I know I was taking them to meetings, and people were blown away by the fact that we were doing this and that you guys were so engaged that you would put on the pink patches. You can see two of them on our captain and our chief over there, and run around town in pink patches. I think it's a healthy thing and a good thing. But aside from that, it was truly an inspiration, and I would just share that my sister's going through cancer, and it's been an essential service for her to have post-operative care.
Yes, and to the chief and the entire department here, on behalf of our entire commission, we want to really thank you for what you're doing here, because this is a super, super big deal. I mean, I don't know. I mean, I think it would be the exception to find a family that has not been affected by breast cancer. I know that I've been touched by it twice in my life, and many people have been touched even more times. So you guys are really doing some wonderful work for us in all ways, and really thanks from the bottom of my heart. So we will now move on to item B.
And acceptance of the Comprehensive Annual Financial Report, or the CAFR, of the Oakland Housing Authority for fiscal year ending June 30th, 2017. And I would like to invite Tracy Stabler up. She is our Chief Financial Officer, and if you have not heard, will be leaving the agency and retiring as of March 1st. So we are very blessed to have had her guidance over the past 5 years, and this will be her final CAFR for us. And I would also like to just, and Victor Mandaba, who is our financial director, is also, raise your hand, Victor, come on up, will also be, come on up, and he'll be taking the reins from Tracy on March 1st. Come on down, Victor.
Excellent.
Tracy, walk us through it.
Good evening, commissioners. Tracy Stabler, Chief Financial Officer.
The comprehensive annual financial report is a package of financial information that was put together by the Government Finance Officers Association. They deemed that your standard balance sheet and income statement was necessary information, but didn't give you enough to kind of get a really good feel of what the agency does. So they have put together a package that says these are the criteria, and you not only give financial statements and the footnotes, which are required, but you also give a lot more statistical information. In the back, you'll see there is generally 10 years of information for everything between from the balance sheet to the income statement to the types of revenue, the types of employees, et cetera. So it's a really good reference for getting a historic look at the agency also. So it's a 200-page document, very comprehensive of our activities for the year ending June 30th, 2017. I'm sure you'll run home and want to read the whole thing, but for tonight, I just want to give you some of the highlights. To kind of give you a walkthrough of how it's laid out, the table of contents really does walk you through very much how it works. The introductory section gives you an executive summary, a highlight, a general organization chart, and how our board is structured. So it kind of gives you the form of what the agency is. The financial section is going to be the audit report. Our auditors, again this year, are Macias Guinea O'Connell LLP. They've been our auditors since 2009. They've actually come in and started with some very big and thick findings, and over the years have worked with us to improve our controls and to actually make improvements or make recommendations for us to make improvements. So we're very happy to work with them. The financial statements themselves are for the fiscal year ending, and then there are other required supplementary information that government auditing standards require us to include, mainly talking about our pension plans. And then other supplementary information is more detailed financial statements, both the balance sheet and income statement, that show you how our federal programs are put together and how some of our non-federal programs are put together. Again, as I mentioned, the statistical section gives you a wealth of information on the agency for a 10-year period. And then our last section is the federal compliance. We are required under government auditing standards to have what's called a single audit. So they go in and look at each one of our federal programs, determine on a risk-based approach which ones need to be looked at. In our case, our biggest program, of course, is MTW, so they're going to look at MTW every year. And then given the size and the timing, they may look at other programs and test those, so they make sure that we're in compliance with all the HUD regulations, with general rules, laws, California regulations. So they will issue an opinion on whether we were in compliance or whether they found a non-compliance or not. So the general layout kind of leads into the first part I would like to note is on page 5 is the Certificate of Achievement for Excellence in Financial Reporting. This is the award that the GFOA does give out when they examine each one of your CAFRs each year. They always issue it 1 year back, as in they've looked at the fiscal year ending 2016 CAFR and deemed it worthy of issuing the certificate. We've now received the certificate four times, which is how many times we've actually submitted it. So we have an excellent track record, and we've also submitted for the fiscal 17 certificate, and we'll find out in the summer if they're going to issue that or not. On page 1 is the actual independent auditor's opinion, which is really the crowning achievement of this, is if we can get an unmodified opinion, which they did. On page 2, they offer, in their opinion, based on the audit and the reports of the auditors, the financial statements referred to above are presented fairly in all material aspects. So we have a clean audit. They did not see anything that was misrepresented, and we've included everything that was required. The next section I would point out is on pages 6 and 8. It's management's discussion and analysis, and this is a very good year-over-year analysis, so it's going to tell you what our general balance sheet looked like this year compared to fiscal 16, and then again on page 8, it's going to be the income and expenses compared to fiscal 16. So in this case, we had our net position increased by $16 million. That was both the fact that we had more revenue coming in than the expenditures that we sent out. It also means that in some cases we increased our assets. In this case, our current assets increased pretty substantially by about almost $16 million.
Yeah, I just wanted to ask a question on that. I've forgotten what exactly the technical definition of net position is. Is that a balance sheet position?
Yes, okay, yes. It's literally the position that's left over from your assets when all of your liabilities have been accounted for. One main thing I would point out, if we just move over to page 13, which is the actual financial statements themselves, the layout is under generally accepted accounting principles for governments. We're required to report on our primary government, which is Oakland Housing Authority, and its two blended component units, California Affordable Housing Initiatives and Oakland Affordable Housing Preservation Initiatives. So by rules, they've been blended into our financials. And then the second column is labeled discretely presented component units. And those are all of our partnerships that we enter into, either tax credit or other projects with them, and they don't meet the definition of being part of our government, but they're so intertwined with our financials that it would be misleading not to put them here. So we represent their activities also as just a side information. Two main things I would point out in the balance sheet this year is under accounts receivable, the U.S. Department of HUD, we went from not having a receivable to having an $18 million receivable this year. Under the HUD cash management changes that they enacted last year, the year before that, they looked at our cash position and decided that they were going to hold up some of our cash. So they gave us the revenue and then kept the cash, so they're holding it in their line of credit facility at HUD, so we're recognizing the fact that that's ours by recognizing it as a receivable.
So we really, hopefully, never mind. Go ahead.
Yes, we're representing it accurately that it's OHA dollars, even if it's in a federal account.
Yeah. Correct. And there were many conversations both with HUD and with the auditors on whether this was appropriate or not, and they agreed that it was. The other thing I would point out is in the next section, the non-current assets, there is a net OPEB, which is other other personnel benefits other than the pension, which is our health care benefits for our retirees, and that increased substantially to almost $13 million. With your permission, we've been pre-funding that because at 6/30/2018, the new GASB, the government auditing standards, number 75 will take effect, where we'll have to, prior to that, just like GASB 68 was for pensions, we did not have to recognize the liability in our financial statements, and next year we will. So we've been pre-funding that in anticipation to pay off that liability when it hits at the end of this fiscal year. Moving over to page 15 is the statement of revenues and expenditures, also referred to as the income statement. That just shows you our revenue streams, which, as you can tell, housing assistance payment revenues of almost $740 million is our primary funding stream. This is both for OHA and our blended component unit, CAHI, that has those revenues, and then likewise in the expenses, the housing assistance payments going out represent our biggest expense. And as I had mentioned, close to the bottom is income loss before capital contributions of $16 million, and that's what's driving the main change in net position for the year. on page 16 is the cash flow statement. That gives you just a very good outlook on how we're spending our funds. So as you can see, a lot of our outgoing is after housing assistance. We have payroll and payments to our vendors for supplies. We expend money in the form of loans to our discretely presented component unit partners. And we also expend quite a bit of money on acquisition of capital assets. So the next section is the note section. That really I'll leave to you to read in detail, but what that does is for any material amount on either the, mostly on the balance sheet, but sometimes on the income statement, there's going to be details. So if you want to know the components of what cash is made up of, there's going to be a footnote that lets you know that. All of our loans receivable, there's extensive details on the quality and with whom we have those loans with. So it's quite a bit of detail. It also talks about in explicit detail each one of our partners and what actual transactions we have with them. I'm going to jump ahead since the footnote section is so big. If you go up to page 61, that is the beginning of the section for the required supplementary. So that's going to give you right now for June 30th, 2017, it's on our pension plans. So it's going to tell you what the liability is, what our assets are valued at, how it is funded compared to the covered payroll. The rules for GASB 68 are that they report in this financial 1 year behind. So the measurement date of our pension plan being reported on is at 6/30/2016 because CalPERS can't get us the information in time to do a current, you know, year. So in the balance sheet, we had a pension liability of $6 million. And as you may recall, we went to the board and asked for permission to pay for that, which you granted, but that didn't get paid until June 30, 2017. So you'll see it adjust next year. It actually shows up as a deferred outflow of resources for pension contributions. So we have a $6 million liability, but we also have a $10 million deferred outflow of the contributions to pay for it. Next year, this schedule, the required supplementary schedule, will actually be expended to start talking about the OPEB liability also. So you'll see similar information to talk about both the assets that are in the trust to pay for it and the liabilities that we may have. If you look at page 67, this is the start of those combining schedules that I had noted earlier. The primary financial statements just get expanded into more columns. So we'll tell you what is the first set of schedules says what are our federal programs, what are our non-federal programs, and what are our general programs are. Those activities that you can't link to anything specific, it just serves the agency as a whole and all programs pay for it. And then we also expand it further starting on page 72 to tell you the different federal programs that we have, of course, our one of our primary being our public housing, the low-rent public housing, our MTW, our VASH program, et cetera. So it gives you the individual income statement and balance sheet on those programs. Starting on page 79 is the statistics. One of the ones I find really helpful is on page 82, and it tells about the operating revenues, and it gives you a very concise kind of summary on the different sources of revenue, our rental income, housing assistance, other grants, et cetera. And then it gives you a 10-year look back on how we've been operating over that period. We also have if you go back to one of the last schedules on page 90, 2 and 93, it gives you just a little detail, again, 10 years of information on how the units of all of our public housing and our OPI blended component unit is set up. It also gives you details on our police department activities, demographics we call them, just some of the service levels that we've been expending over the last 10 years. So the last section starts at page 95. And again, we have the opinions of the auditors. They're, for the single audit, they're required to issue two separate reports. One is our internal controls over our financial reporting itself, as well as our compliance with general laws, regulations, contracts, et cetera. So that starts on 95. They don't issue an opinion like they do on the financial statements. They issue basically a no comment letter. So what you want to hear is that we noted no instances. So in this case, they noted no internal control weaknesses, nor did they note any instances of noncompliance. On page 97 is the second report that they issue, and those are the specific opinions on our internal controls over our federal programs that they test and on compliance with the requirements of each federal program. So HUD and all federal agencies are required to put out a supplement every year that says these are the requirements of each program, and this is what you have to do to ensure you're reporting properly, that you're only bringing in qualified participants, et cetera. So the auditors will take all those requirements and then pull a sample of our data and test it to see if we're in compliance. In this case, we had one material weakness that is in the eligibility. We've had it in prior years, but I'm happy to say we've gone from instances of noncompliance or indications of internal control of sometimes up to 20. We're down to 2 right now. So they, out of the whole sample they tested, I think it was about 150 participants, they found 2 instances where the paperwork wasn't perfect. So then they tell us we just need to clean it up a little bit. So hopefully by next year, Richter will report that we have no material weaknesses and no noncompliance.
The one thing I do want to...
Hey, the bar's up here for you.
One thing I do want to, that we, if I can refer you to page 39, you want to flip back. When we have on our OPI disposition, we have a one-for-one replacement that we agreed to with HUD. Actually, we proposed it. It isn't required for HUD. We wanted to find a way to track it with HUD, and it will. Anytime we have one of those units that has been approved for sale and it sells, we've agreed to list that unit's address and the replacement unit in our audit so that there's a public record of it. And if you go to page 35, you can see some single-family homes that were sold, the date of sale, and where the replacement unit actually exists. So it has a direct unit number, and it's a one-for-one. We have this completely mapped over the previous, but we aren't selling anything, clearly, except for when single-family homes become vacant. And then we put these up for sale during this fiscal year. It was actually in late 2016. But I wanted you to know that. So if anybody in the neighborhood or community is interested in where, you know, if we sold this single-family home, Viola Street, where's the replacement unit? It's in our audits every single year if we take
right,
that action.
Right, so this now quantifies.
Is a permanent record. We actually, anyone can look it up.
Right, we actually have a track record.
Yep.
Yeah.
Cool. Anything else?
No, actually, it was perfect segue because that was the end of the report that as I was going to present it, so I just wanted to see if you had any questions or comments.
Cool. No questions? Commissioner Castillo has a question.
So on page 102, it talks about the, it's a material weakness in internal control concerning our risk-based inspection. Is that because we're transitioning from one to the other and it hasn't quite caught up yet?
It's primarily because of the way we've set it up. We haven't been able to customize our business system to actually give us credible reports on when the reinspection is due, because the current business system will tell you when the inspection is due for each year, but on the risk-based, we're going to 2 and 3 years, mm-hmm. and we haven't actually been able to get them to customize the program in such a way that we can rely on it giving us when those second and third years. So,
and what's the fix for that?
Well, we are in negotiations right now for a contract that incorporates the customization in it. So
you already had agreed to do the customization in Voyager 6, which is where we are currently, and have failed to do so. Mm-hmm. They've quit doing updates on Voyager 6 because it's an obsolete platform, and they want you to go to 7, which is in the cloud. We are extremely close after a year of torturous negotiations, and difficult negotiations on a number of issues. And in fact, I think we have pretty much at the last, this afternoon, we're pretty much ready now to sign that. They have a certain protocol for inspection periods in there that would work. We may modify our MTW activity a little bit to meet what they currently offer in 7, because otherwise it's a customization and it costs a great deal of money to get that put into the system. And so that's, we had agreed years ago to pay it to get it into 6, but it just has not occurred. So we're looking at what we're going to do with 7 to in the MTW activity so they match so we can start implementing it. It's in here because it's not in the business system in a way that we can generate reports and have accuracy. So it's still manual. It comes up every year and we have to do it manually, and that's why there's the confusion.
Our intention is still to provide relief for staff time and staff work, and also give like seniors on limited permanent incomes some relief as far as, right?
That's still absolutely the goal. And the risk-based inspections is actually not the annual, the
so
interim.
So it's different.
That's a second customization.
Yeah, that's a different customization. But risk-based inspections have to do, if you go out the first time and it passes the first time, we may not see you for a couple years because we don't need to. If it fails, then we'll come right back. We're trying to do our inspections based on the number of fails. So if you could end up being inspected every 6 months or once every 3 years, depending on how you perform as a landlord.
This is the housing unit that's getting inspected.
Yeah.
Section 8?
Yes.
Right. Okay, Section 8 first-timers.
No, like when every year.
Every year.
It's required every year under normal circumstances, but we've got a waiver from HUD to do risk-based, so it doesn't need to be done every year based on the
previous inspection. Right.
Customizing that is where... So because we have this special piece of approval from HUD, it is not built into any system. So we have to customize the standard system to do what we want it to do.
Oh, wow. That seems really complicated.
We find that we lead the way with our business system. We're teaching them how to do it. So
Yeah. I'm sure. There were some documents located in the actual packet itself. One was... Page 6, I guess it's a copy of page 6. And also page 5. I was just hoping you could kind of explain it to me, because I'm not sure what this is, particularly page 5. It says to improve the, I'm not sure what it is. Could you break it down for me? Because it's just, the language is so kind of...
Okay. Well, one of the things that we included is, you may be seeing it's this report that comes from the auditors. Mm-hmm. What they were finding back in the days of Enron, when auditors were getting in a lot of trouble for not performing adequate audits, is that there was a disconnect between when the auditors talked to management and then when auditors talked to the board. And so there was a lot more pressure put on the auditors to perform in such a way to make the management happy, but they were reportable to the board. So what came out of that was, this is called a SAS 114 because it's the Statement of Auditing Standards number 114 that requires them annually to directly report to you as the board. So what they're doing is they're giving you a summary in this report of how the conduct of the audit was itself. So they're going to tell you if I argued with them or if I asked for a second opinion because I didn't agree with them, if they had any problems getting a hold of documents or if we, you know, didn't make things accessible to them or not. So they're telling you basically that we had a pretty standard audit. You know, they're telling you some of the major assumptions that I make when I actually make the entries to accrue differences. What are the big things that are estimates that you may say, how did you do this and why did you do it a certain way? They also are bringing to your attention things that you want to think about next year when you do get to number pages 5 and 6 here. These are things that are going to happen in the future, and you may hear us bring them to you. As I mentioned, on page 5, they're talking about the new other post-employment benefits. That's that GASB 75 we referred to earlier, where we've been positioning ourselves. We know at the end of June 30th, 18, we're going to have to recognize a liability. Okay. Sure.
That's the one that I was curious about.
Okay.
So are they okay with how we're doing it, or is there some kind of issue?
No, in this case, they're telling you, because at the top it says informational comments.
Right.
They're telling you it's going to hit next year.
Okay.
And so that might be something you want to kind of get yourself up to speed. You can start asking questions about how is this going to impact our agency? What are we doing about it?
Okay. Thank you very much.
Mm-hmm.
Any other questions? I just wanted to make a comment here, you know, because we look at these numbers and we just kind of read them, and there they are, and everybody's like, wow, there they are, there's numbers. And revenue of $807 million. Well, I just want to point out that $807 million is getting within striking distance of $1 billion. I'm just putting this in scale.
Yeah.
But what is significant about this is the fact that we are the Oakland Housing Authority, not the California Authority or the U.S. I mean, this is an Oakland-focused enterprise. And so it is just important to keep in mind of how large a scale this really is. There's nothing else that I can imagine that is having this much of an effect on Oakland, other than maybe the aggregate of property taxes coming in or something like that. But the other takeaway from this is we are hardly solving the housing problem in Oakland. We're hardly solving it, okay? I mean, so you're looking at this thing, and this gives one, I think, an idea of what the scale of the mountain is that is really being faced here. I mean, we're at almost $1 billion level. The need is just obvious driving around town and looking at the homeless encampments and the size of the wait lifts, the wait list and all of this sort of thing. So, you know, I'm just encouraging people to just kind of like look at these numbers and go like, wow, there's some meaning behind this, you know, and it really kind of helps us understand, you know, what really needs to happen, not just in Oakland, but I mean in other cities as well. So,
and I would point out that our budget is, you know, as you say, approaching the 1B mark. I think, first off, because we do the project-based rental assistance HAP distribution is what blows our budget from $300 million to $800. So I want to be clear that the majority of that is a direct pass-through to 41,000 families in Northern California, which includes some buildings in Oakland, but the majority of the district. Because of that, I believe we are the second largest HUD-funded agency in the state, right behind City of Los Angeles, who also does the PBRA program. But it's a huge responsibility to realize how many lives are dependent on our ability to accurately and correctly distribute the funding and to be responsible to our folks. But we are not $1 billion for Oakland. We're not $800 million for Oakland. We are about $300 million for Oakland, which is still incredible.
Mm-hmm.
And when you realize that like you point out, that we haven't gotten more than a couple tablespoons of water in a very big bucket to solve what really needs to happen. So, but I wanted to point that out.
I think it's pretty impressive if you look and say for 800 million of activity our agency processes a year, we only have administrative expenses of less than 40 million. So I think we're very lean and efficient in doing what we do.
Yeah, well, I was just going to say that when we look at revenue, this isn't like a normal business, because most of the revenue is actually flow-through revenue. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's actually getting to where it's supposed to go. It just, as you pointed out, it's not getting sucked up by overhead or whatever. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's actually going through and it's reaching the targets, whatever it is. That just makes it all the more significant in many ways.
It does. But one of the things that the board has done, particularly over the past, you know, since disposition in 2010, is that was the first act that actually repositioned portfolios away from a deficit to where they actually can sustain. So you took 1,554 units and moved them where they were generating about $9 million a year deficit plus to this agency, and have turned them into something that actually, through the project-based Section 8 program, now is not only getting rehabbed and sustained, but it actually dramatically increased our budgets between those years, because suddenly we were getting accurate funding from D.C. to manage those units. That helped. The other thing we did that has been very helpful for everyone in the Oakland-Fremont metropolitan area is we led the cause to raise the FMRs in 2015 when HUD wanted to lower them. It was dramatic for us and our bottom line, but it was also dramatic and important for all of the project-based Section 8 providers in those two counties, which are Contra Costa and Alameda County. It improved the pro forma on the properties, and you, even if you remember the last meeting for Ave Vista, we were able to close out a deal and go get some additional credit to close out what needed to happen there so we could make that complete because of the increased income, because of the increased in fair market rents. So those have driven sort of an increase in revenue for us, in addition to bringing things like the you know, Jobs Plus grant, which was nearly three, and some other things. The real driver for us is housing assistance payments and their payment standards. We are somewhat blessed to still be the most affordable neighborhood in the East Bay. So we end up not expending as much as San Francisco per family, even as the county of Alameda spends, I believe, more in HAP per family than we do in Oakland. And that means that we are able to cash flow that under MTW and then increase it with development. And the other thing driving that is when we do development deals and we budget that amount, those deals are worth a great deal of outside money as well that is non-HUD, and that goes into our budget. And so it ends up amplifying the money that we get in a very amazing way. The last pit, which I think is also what you were pointing out, is we have a huge economic influence on a number of businesses in Oakland for building materials. And every July, when we come with those POs, those very large POs on where we're spending our money, it's really important to watch that. We don't need to, under HUD rules, come to the board with that list, but I want the world and you to know where the businesses and the local businesses and also the chains that we use, but where, who's benefiting every single day from our maintenance guys out there buying materials, our construction company out there buying construction goods and services, as well as the employment that we do. I think it's a really huge picture for the city of Oakland. I think we contribute an enormous amount of economic drive to the city, and we did so in the middle of the recession, and we're doing so now. And I think that's been a benefit people don't often talk about with us, is our buying power. And that's all for that one. Any other questions?
Barbara.
Yeah, I just want to comment on that when you talked about the businesses. On page 87, it talks about the principal employers in Oakland. And it gives the history, I mean, of the principal. Could you kind of just elaborate on that? Because I'm looking at the employer, the number of employees, and I'm kind of looking at the number there. And so could you just kind of elaborate on that?
So to qualify for the certificate of achievement, you have to follow the format. They tell you what the content of your CAFR should include. And in the statistical area, a lot of these are designed for general governments like the city of Oakland, who in those cases you're very much more attuned to what your tax bases are. So a lot of times you include the demographics of your employment because that lets you know how many people are in the city, you know, creating sales tax revenue, who's buying homes and paying property taxes, the businesses that are paying sales taxes and other, you know, fuel taxes, et cetera. So it's very informative that we put it in here. And as you can tell, the source comes from the City of Oakland's CAFR themselves because they're required to include it. So this happens to be a report that it may not have a one-to-one or a direct correlation to our business, mm-hmm. but it's required under the GFOA rules for the CAFR. And so we think it's valuable. It gives you an idea of how the demographics of your employers change from one period to the next, the 10-year period. So it lets you know, what major employers may be moving in or out of the area and how many employees they, you know, have in their payrolls.
But it's useful general information about the City of Oakland, OUSD, mm-hmm. who our major employers are. I mean, I was staggered to learn that Kaiser is our major employer at over 12,000. If you look at Southwest, such an important employer on the private sector, 2,500 people. And many of our residents work there.
Thank you.
Very interesting. Thank you.
All right. Moving on to item C. Item C is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to execute a 3-year contract with 2 additional 1-year option terms with Alameda County Social Services Agency to provide local housing assistance to specific CalWORKs families in an amount not to exceed $5 million over the 5-year term. We're being joined by Andreas Manriquez, our chief operating officer, and Michelle Hassan, our director of leased housing. This is something that we started 3 years ago. And it's been a long road, and I first just want, before I turn it over, want to give just a sort of large shout out first to Lori Cox, who you have met with, who's been engaged from the beginning with the board, and Linda Gardner from Housing Community Development, who has also been really behind this, particularly in the first year with the Special Needs Ad Hoc Committee and meeting with us. We are also joined today by 2 people who are essential in making it happen. Andrea Ford, raise your hand, Andrea. She's the Alameda County Social Services Agency Assistant Director, Agency Director for Workforce Benefits and Administration, and Riley Wilkerson, raise your hand, Riley. He's Housing Community Development Manager for the Alameda County Housing and Community Development Department, and I'm grateful that they're here and grateful for the partnership. I'll turn it over to you.
Good evening, Commissioners. Again, like Eric said, this is something that has been a long road, you know, and a lot of hard work from, you know, many in this agency, from, you know, other agencies, and also from the board in itself. So I'm going to turn it over to Michelle so she can do her presentation.
Good evening, Commissioners. Michelle Hassan, Director of Leased Housing. I'm very pleased to bring for your approval the Building Bridges CalWORKs program. The memorandum that is in front of you is for you to consider authorizing the executive director to execute a 3-year contract with 2 additional 1-year options with Alameda County Social Services Agency to provide local housing subsidy with the goal of stabilizing the household and improving outcomes for the families and children that are served. The program will serve a minimum of 50 CalWORKs participants per month. And just so that people understand the acronym CalWORKs, it stands for California Work Opportunity and Responsibility to Kids. The proposed funding is $1 million per year and is included in our fiscal 18 budget. I'd like to just take you back to 2014 when the board reviewed the and adopted Resolution 4589. This spoke to a shared vision for improving life outcomes through affordable housing. The purpose of that action was to improve the life outcomes of low-income households that the authority served. The Rezo acknowledged that housing is the foundation for families and individuals to achieve and sustain positive outcomes in most other areas of their lives. The new Building Bridges CalWORKS program is a direct result of the focused work and shared vision of this board to improve the life outcome of the families that we serve. Through your vision, the Special Needs Ad Hoc Committee was established in 2015. I'd like to acknowledge the committee members, Janie Castillo, Vice Chair Marlene Hurd, and Lynette Jung Lee. The committee identified two key strategies, system alignment and leveraging resources for the identified two pilot programs, one being CalWORKS. All Building Bridges programs have as the foundation a goal of incorporating these strategies while designing local programs to serve populations with special needs. Once the board shared its vision, the Housing Authority started meeting with Alameda County Social Services Agency. And in 2016, an important component was completed with our partnership. We entered into an MOU, Memorandum of Understanding, as a precursor to our program development. The MOU allows for OHA and Alameda County to share information about families as necessary to administer the program and meet MTW reporting requirements. A copy of that MOU is included in your board packet. For the past 6 months, Director Lenita Ellis, the Director of Family and Community Partnerships, and I have attended planning meetings with the Alameda County staff, specifically Andrea Ford and Riley Wilkerson. So what is Building Bridges CalWORKS? CalWORKS is an employment-based program that requires employable adults to participate in work-related activities in order to receive aid. Many families in Alameda County employment and cash benefit programs are in need of stable housing. Our partners have shared with us that the need is not, there is not enough housing support. To support that need, the State of California Department of Social Services has a housing support program, which is administered by Alameda County Social Services Agency. The Alameda County Social Services Agency serves residents who are on the path to economic stability through the Housing Support Program. You'll see it mentioned as HSP. The Housing Support Program provides temporary housing support for families in the CalWORKS program who are experiencing homelessness. The HSP program is targeted specifically to families that are literally homeless on the streets or in shelters, or are in receipt of a court-ordered eviction. In Alameda County, HSP is a collaboration of Alameda County Social Services, Housing and Community Department, Community Development Department, and contracted nonprofit agencies such as Building Futures for Women and Children, East Oakland Community Project, and Abode Services. CalWORKS assistance is limited. Generally, the parents have a specific limited amount, and if they have children, they can get up to 48 months of benefits. Alameda County and its partners provide the wraparound housing stability services, which include housing search assistance, security deposit assistance, utility deposits, as well as assisting families with paying for arrears in terms of utility cost, moving cost, and furniture cost. Rental assistance payments, however, are of a limited duration, 6 months to 1 year. Through CalWORKS, HSP provides families, program families are expected to, and supported to, are expected to increase their income. Each family has its own individual support plan and an assigned social worker. So what does the Oakland Housing Authority do? What is our role? The goal of OHA Building Bridges CalWORKS program is to act as a stabilizing factor in the form of housing assistance for up to 2 years once the county's support is reduced and while the family is still participating in the CalWORKS program. The family rent portion is based on their employment income and other benefits. The range of OHA housing support will be up to $1,500. All referred families to OHA will complete a minimal eligibility screening for income eligibility, mandatory sex registrant, and eligible citizenship as is required for all of our local programs. Families will be entered into the Boston Post tracking for tracking purposes and for ease in gathering MTW data. All units must meet housing quality standards. The range, the county, HCD, and nonprofit partners will meet regularly to review program impact, our processes, and the progress of enrolled families. Based on funding eligibility, families who successfully complete the Building Bridges CalWORKS program and maintain their housing may be referred for eligibility screening for a housing choice voucher. This completes my report, and I'm available for any questions. So actually, when the families, before we can start to pay subsidy on the families that are enrolled in CalWORKS, they have to be referred to OHA. So the first referral is for the CalWORKS Building Bridges program. And that's where we'll do a minimal screening, like most of our other programs, sponsor-based, et cetera. At the point where they are referred, they complete CalWORKS, and they are still in stable housing, they'll be referred again for a step up to Housing Choice Voucher, and at that time, all of the regular HCV required screening will happen.
Program sounds very good. I just have a couple of questions. excuse me. I guess the first is looking at the evaluation that's occurring programmatically, what that evaluation is looking at, what at this point, as the program comes together, the organizations are looking at in terms of what they, kind of what the organizational goals are above and beyond resident outcomes. If there's anything about the systems piece of it that's being reviewed. It's kind of paired with the question about alignment. Mm-hmm. I know that this one isn't a program that's focused so much on alignment, but wondering about how much of systems alignment is part of this program from the standpoint of the person who is utilizing the services.
So I'm going to, Andre might be able to come up and give more information, but what our goal is that each of the partners are working on what they do best. So Alameda County is providing the CalWORKS subsidy. HCD is working with the nonprofit providers. The nonprofit providers are case managing and working directly with the families. So each of us has a role in building Bridges CalWORKS. Would you like to add anything?
Sure. So Andrea Ford again, Alameda County Social Services. So I think the end goal is to get them a job so that they can sustain their housing.
Riley Wilkerson, HCD, and from Andrea's view, that's their mission. Ours is to get them housed, and these are homeless families. The latest homeless count in 2017 said that at a point in time, there's about just under 300 homeless families at any point in time, and if you look over the course of a year, it's probably 2 to 3 times that amount. So it's like everything else, like you were pointing out earlier. The need far outweighs what we're able to provide, but this would be a real huge boost to be able to extend some of these short-term subsidies, give them the chance to become self-sufficient through SSA's program, and if they still can't be self-sufficient in the housing that we've got for them, then we'll look at stepping them up into a housing choice voucher. But it's a kind of it buys us a little more time to really work with people with SSA's programs to keep them stably housed and become self-sufficient on their own.
And what we know is that if you're a single head of household with two children who are trying to rent an apartment here, it's probably going to be over 2,000.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
And it would take 3 full-time jobs to do that. And what we're trying to do with this one, and an item that will come Building Bridges probably next month, another program, is really do be an interrupter And this continuum, which is the county doing the work with the CalWORKs moms to improve their employability, get them employed and get them off, and with Housing Community Development doing the work to try and clear up their credit, pay for their security deposit, find a place, get them housed, and get them stabilized, are kind of both heroic pieces of work that are being funded through two different agencies in the county. What is missing is the long-term survivability and thrivability of the family. So having then at the exit of this program, being able to have them come through the application process for the standard Section 8 program, to me is really the breakthrough and really can change the trajectory of that family and those children for the next generation. They won't go through a cycle of being housing insecure again, devoting 50 to 60 to 70% of their income to rent, and actually have a chance to impact the educational lifetime achievement of, outcome of not just the head of household, but the children growing up in that unit. So that's where I think the big innovation is for us. And in the first meeting we were talking with the county, it was how many years they wanted to try and the systems are aligned, but in a weird, they're handoffs in this case. So the work's being done by the county and then they're handing them off to us. What we're doing is giving a larger runway in the county programs. And if they can't sustain beyond that, they can come to us and apply to be on the Section 8 program. And I think that's the smartest alignment of government in these programs I've ever heard. And I don't know how any taxpayer wouldn't applaud us for trying to do this kind of alignment. But it isn't easy. And I would tell you that even, you know, we both have large, complicated jobs. And to get the three of groups together here and work it out has been terrific. And some of the simplifications and that Michelle didn't go into some of the details about sharing data, about sharing information on clients so they don't have to go through the process and through the process and through the process, and setting up secure servers to move documents back and forth so that we can do the assistance through that. She mentioned Boston Post. That's an online property management software, but it can track the participation in this very easily, and it means that they can log on and do it, and we can pull the reports and have access as well. That kind of stuff, I think, is another issue of systems alignment because they just don't align business systems.
Yeah, that was the part that I was curious about, so I'm glad to hear that. And huge kudos for everyone who worked on the data sharing piece, because I know how challenging that can be. So,
and the goal was just to use your files so that nobody has to go through it twice.
Right, because in social services, we collect the same thing that they would be asking for, so it's just an easy ask. They have to turn it to us for eligibility purposes. To receive CalWORKs. So. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Very cool. Sure.
Thank you. I'm very excited about helping these families. So my first question is there a time limit on CalWORKs of 48 months?
48 consecutive months for the adult only, but we will continue to aid the children until they age out, which is age 18 or up to 19.
So that's a $80 to $100 difference out of their checks?
About $131 so when they're taken off the grant.
After 2 years?
After four years. 48 months.
48 months, okay. So if our program takes a little time to get on its feet, like the process of getting them into the program and starting the subsidy and finding the housing, let's say that's 3 or 4 months, is there some flexibility in allowing them to extend that time out, or is it just flat, that's how much time they get?
For the most part, it's flat. If you are a victim of domestic abuse, we can extend the time. If you are caring for an ill or incapacitated family member, we can extend the time. So there are some exemptions to that time limit.
But even if after the 48 months pass, they retain their eligibility for this program?
I understand that, okay. But their income goes down significantly. Yes. And then you're talking about they're inside, but they're still living in abject poverty. And when we talk about homeless families, we're talking about complicated issues. And you could very well find people that are unemployable because of the debilitating conditions that are in the family. So this is a wonderful program, but if we're going to help someone, let's see how far we can go as far as giving them wraparound services and considering that maybe employment isn't going to be the road for all of these families.
And that's part of the assessment that's done with every family in terms of their ability to become self-sufficient. Many of the families that come into this program come in after their 48 months have passed. So it's just their children on this, and then we have a very short-term subsidy. So this really will assist us in giving those families a longer chance to either work, either to find, to become self-sufficient through employment, or if they can't get employed, to be able to get other types of subsidized housing as well, or a housing choice voucher.
Thank you. I believe it. I could feel the passion in your heart. is there linkages to child care?
Absolutely. Child care is a key component to the CalWORKs Welfare to Work program, along with transportation allowance.
Okay, that's good. My last thing is that last month we were presented with a wonderful organization. I think it's Rising Sun Energy, right? Mm-hmm. Do I have it right? And they have this wonderful construction program that they're opening up, and I'm sure you guys have thought of it, right? Connecting our CalWORKs family with the Rising Sun Construction Training Program.
Yes, they're located in Berkeley.
Yes, they
and
are.
And I've sat around the table with them a couple Excellent. Times, and we've referred our CalWORKs clients for training and job placement.
Thank you very much. And then we're going to get referrals through the organizations that you mentioned, Building Futures, and then there were two others, right?
The referral process as it stands now is SSA identifies families
homeless.
Who are homeless
right.
and non-CalWORKs and then refers them to us.
Yes.
And then they're generally geographically spread throughout the county, so we spread them out that way.
So I know of families who are living in our encampments, so I could reach out to advocates and let them know about this program and refer them to social services. Is that correct? Is that how the process is going to go?
If they're on CalWORKs, they should have a worker, and they would just contact their worker there and say they're homeless.
So that they can initiate, can I see if I qualify for this project?
Right.
Okay, thank
but
you.
Right now, we're not taking any more people in because we don't have any capacity.
Mm-hmm.
This will give us more capacity.
Okay, thank you. I guess my next question would be, when will we be able to put the capacity on board? Thank you.
As soon as we can get some aid. Yeah.
When you say yes, when you say
yes.
Thank you.
One final thing. I just want to personally thank Michelle Hassan and Lenita Wheeler for their work on this. Their flexibility and creativity have just been outstanding, and working together with them has been really easy and bring us all together. So I just want to personally thank
you. I echo that and also thank Eric.
thank you.
Yeah, we can roll anytime.
I move to adopt
Shall I make
the
a motion to move the item?
I think it is.
I think
you
I just
do that?
And just move.
Second it then?
And
I second
you may
it.
Certainly
you.
Second it.
Yes.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? We're in.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, so now I think we have moved to item D.
We are on item D, which is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director to execute two-year contracts with three additional one-year option terms with the following firms: BDO USA LLP, RSM USA LLP, and the Bronner Group LLC for as-needed internal audit and planning services in a combined amount not to exceed $100,000 per year for the initial two-year term and each subsequent one-year term if exercised. This has been done through our Planning, Implementation, and Compliance Department, who looks over internal audits. Dominica Henderson, our director, is here if you want to come up in case we have any questions. This is actually so we can get a diverse list to look at internally different operations that have different skill sets. Years ago, we had one internal auditor that was challenged, I would tell you, and I don't think what came out of the one person was beneficial because they often didn't know what they were auditing. If you know Section 8, if you know police, the diversity of our agency requires a diverse level of consulting, is I guess what we're saying through this. And so what Dominica is proposing through her RFP is to come forward with three firms that, based on our internal audit plan, she can assign to different firms based on their area of expertise. I'm very much looking forward to getting these in place and having every year a certain number of audits done and internally. It's essential for us to test. You were talking about, for example, in the single audit, you're talking about some of the compliance and file errors. Mm-hmm. That's an internal audit issue. If you can get ahead of the internal audit, it'll never be in the single audit. And do the corrections. And we've used in the past, we had a contract with Bronner Group, and Bronner Group has given us great wisdom and advice on general services. They looked at our the police have what's it called? Thank you. The asset forfeiture process and expenditures for our police department, because I wanted to make sure all that was being done in accordance with state law and requirements. It was. It's very helpful, though, for all of us, including, in this case, the chief, to have that completely vetted by an internal auditor, get the report. If there's anything we need to make an adjustment, let's make it now. Let's not wait for our single audit to find it. And that's what this is about. And I don't know if you want to add anything, Dominica, about your plan or what you see.
Well, we have had the contract with the Bronner Group. This RFP was really important for us because it gives us another possible 5 years so that we don't have an expiration issue, so we can really begin to implement our risk assessment plan and go forward with various audits so that we can make sure we're in compliance in both the program areas, financial areas, and other areas that we may have not had the capacity to pay as much attention to. We'll have much more capacity now with these three firms.
And that concludes our report.
Thank you. Do we have questions?
That explanation helped, and I move the approval of the 2-year contracts with the 3 additional 1-year option terms with the 3 firms.
Good.
Second.
All those in favor?
Aye.
I know there's no one opposed. No, but is there anyone opposed or abstentions? All right, carries unanimously.
Thank you, commissioners.
Okay, so yes, thank you. This is really a good idea. So item E.
Item E is consideration of a resolution authorizing the executive director or their designee to act as an agent to perform banking transactions and designate authorized signers on all Oakland Housing Authority bank accounts. This is an item that is coming before you because Tracy Stabler is retiring. She was designated first as the director of finance, and then we had to come back and designate her when her title changed to chief financial officer. And should, in the debate about what to do about how often we, if there's a title change or a name change, we need board authority, and this is the person who handles our bank accounts. We talked to our banks, and they accept a designee from the executive director. But what I would like to do, Tracy, if you can come up and just tell us briefly what you perform in this role. It isn't, they designate check signers, and we do the auto check, but what that functions, the person does who is designated by the authority. And I would tell you, I'm not something who I don't really want to do this. I think it needs to be the finance director. I just want to be able to make sure if we lost a finance director readily, we could quickly have, I could designate someone else and not have to wait for a board meeting.
Good evening again, Tracy Stabler, Chief Financial Officer. So the bank contracting officer is the one authorized to basically communicate with the bank. They only want to deal with one person to know that all transactions that we would attempt to do as an agency are consolidated to one person. So that would include opening or closing new bank accounts. It would also include, we have several company credit cards that go through the same bank. It also includes our ability to wire transfer monies between our agency and other agencies or other large vendors. It also involves, we have very complex lockbox transactions where all of our tenants can deposit their checks so that it gets automated. Any authorization to allow people to get access to the computer systems that give any of this information out. They're also the person who is designated as the contact. So if you are ever in a situation where there may be fraud, there may be an overdrawn account, they know that they can call the one person and they're always available to answer the questions, or be, more or less, they don't want to do anything such as change a signer or delete a person unless that one contact is aware of it and is in agreement with it.
And you're the one contract person now?
I am right now, yes. I was designated when Janet Rice retired about 3 years ago.
It is, and that's why I do. That's why, as, when I sign the resolution, the next thing I sign is a delegation to Victor.
Okay, gotcha. All right, thank you.
The one thing I also wanted to add is as in talking the item over with the chairs, one of the things I really want to do is make sure every time I delegate someone, I will put it in the board packet, so the board is always aware as who's delegated the authority to. And as I've just informed you, the first one will be Victor, but I'll put it in the board packet.
Okay. I thank you for the explanation. That helps again as well. It does raise a couple of questions for me. Is one, do we have more than one financial institution at which we hold accounts?
Yes, we our primary institution we deal with is MUFG Union Bank, used to be Union Bank of California before they were merged. We have approximately 54 accounts with them. Then we have Bridge Bank, which used to be called Torrey Pines. We have Bank of the West. We have Community Bank of the Bay, all for various small escrow or single-purpose type accounts that we keep isolated from the main concentrated banking at Union.
Then, okay, that helps to know. I think it's good to not have all your money in one place.
We're a government agency, so by California regulation, we have to be collateralized, so we don't have the FDIC risk that a for-profit company would have. Mm-hmm. Our deposits are required to be collateralized by the bank to protect them.
Okay. And I'm sorry, could you explain collateralized?
Okay, so a bank, you know, when they have their deposits, they can use those funds in turn to lend them out as mm-hmm. loans to other people, you know, and then the whole concept of you have to have a certain amount of reserves on hand to be able to clear deposits at any given time. As a government agency, they're not allowed to use our funds in that way. They have to collateralize them. That means they have to show that they have them on deposit and they're in a secured, generally either U.S. Treasury or federal agency type deposit. Okay. So they can't take any risk with either our deposits or on our behalf to loan them out or to place them somewhere that is not deemed almost a zero risk.
So it's 100% reserve ratio, basically.
Correct.
And just because I think that this is still a huge responsibility for any one person, even as you delegate it, just wondering about how the checks and balance system works, so that there is some internal control or audit.
Right. Well, as part of our annual audit, when our independent auditors, Macias, Ginny O'Connell, come in, one of the first things they do is they always require us to give a list of all of our deposits, all of our bank accounts. They look specifically for any changes in signers that we've made and why. Why have we opened or closed accounts? They'll question it, and they'll start looking. The very first thing they do in an audit is a variance analysis, where they'll come in and look at every balance we have and try to say, does the projected change tell me why your cash might have gone down or up significantly? And then they'll tie that back to the audited financial statements. And if it doesn't make sense, they'll go in deeper into, you know, exploring why something might have changed.
Yes.
Yes, I just want to ask, so previously the board authorized the chief financial officer. So what department within the housing would this designee come from? Where would?
Historically, it's always been the director of finance for as long as we've been an agency. That did change when Janet Rice was here for a couple of years. She was the deputy executive director of administration. She took it on, and it was actually related more to the gap between before we hired you and there were people here. And then when she left, Janet took it over, and that's when we came back for the memo. So it's but prior to that, it was always the director of finance who handles all our accounts.
And Janet's title actually was, I believe, deputy executive for the Office of Program Administration and Finance.
Yeah.
So she was directly responsible for the department.
Yes, I had one question, which is along the same lines as yours, Commissioner Lee. Actually, I was chatting with Eric about this earlier today, because I looked at this and I was actually surprised that Eric didn't already have that capability, okay? And so when I was talking to Eric about it, I said, this shouldn't be something that, like, I or anybody really needs to think about, because this is a pretty well-trodden path of how you manage check authorizations and cash and checks and balances and all this in systems. So, I mean, if I were really, the person I really wanted to ask on this would be our auditors. Like, is this cool? I mean, are there any risks with this? Is there anything that we need to know about doing this? Because, I mean, it seems like it would make sense for Eric to have the authority and then delegate it, you know, but then I started thinking about it, and I said, well, I don't know, somewhere along the line of history, did we discover some risks there in doing that? And so that's really not the right way to do it, because we obviously hadn't done that in the first place. So I just want to know if you know, or if anybody here knows, if there are, because I'm kind of a believer, you know, in general accounting standards and procedures, and this, in my view, would be like a standard procedure for internal controls. It's just that I haven't worked in this world for so long that I just don't remember what's right and wrong or what risks there are. That's why I rely on others.
There's a risk in everything. So the real idea is that you're mitigating the risk to the lowest level you possibly can. That being said, you also don't want to choke yourself operationally that you can't get your business done. So one of the steps, I think, why we're doing it this way now is prior to my joining the agency and being promoted to chief financial officer, you only had one title in the finance department, which was director of finance. So now we're finding that because of having that kind of extra layer of management and having a chief financial officer, we found here with my retirement that you're not going to have a chief financial officer, or right away you will not. So all of a sudden you have a vacancy in your most important banking position. So
right.
What we're trying to do is say we're not tying it to the title now. We're tying it to, I think the way Eric and I had looked at it was that you're always going to have, by your bylaws, you have to have an executive director. So you will always have that position. And then his ability to delegate, depending on what title and person is in a position, it will almost always be the head of your finance department.
Yes, so. But I think that my question on this is Eric is not like any other employee, because he is the top of the, he's at the top of the pyramid. So he is the executive which can make all decisions. So if he's at the top of the decision ladder and has full financial authority to sign checks, mess with accounts, and that kind of thing, is there an issue with that, or is there not? That was really my question.
Because, it's for general accounting kind of principles, is that risky? Or is it more risky to have it delegated to the finance director?
Exactly. I don't know.
I'm not certain either.
I don't
That's
even
why
have an opinion.
Well, legally, he could usurp that authority at any time. If he was to walk into the bank and say, you know, my chief financial officer just took off to Haiti and is going to stay there the rest of her life and didn't have the ability to get the board together, he would, in an emergency basis, they're going to say, who are you? And they're going to accept him as the lead official of the agency.
Okay, then that answers the total question.
Right.
You have the power anyway.
I think
so. We don't even need to vote.
Yeah, except
I
don't
want to extremely, do it. It would be more of a legal nightmare. They would require a lot more work to get it done,
sure,
as opposed to having the resolution.
Sure.
That lets them cover their liabilities that they're following all the steps.
Yes.
As far as his having the ability, he is a check signer on all the accounts.
Yes.
Just by virtue of, you have to have a certain number of signers, and that is one of the least, considered the least risky positions, because they have more of a stake in running the agency and, you know, are less likely to have a personal, you know, agenda in using the agency. So I don't think, as far as the auditors are concerned, that they're going to come in and say that position is any more risky than my position or a different director's position.
That, I mean,
and we did talk to the banks as well, and this is not uncommon, and they accept the delegation memo.
That's fine. I mean, my question was purely technical. Is this standard operating procedure, or is it accepted operating procedure, yes or no? That's really all. Because I just don't know. And when I don't know something, then I'm a little nervous about just saying, let's do it.
Well, generally speaking, the bank is always going to prefer the top official, the executive director, to have that power, but operationally it becomes a nightmare, because Eric has to be then available for every phone call, every wire transfer,
that
just makes it more complicated. So you've delegated it to finance, because that's what their function is.
Yeah, you can see the smile on his face, how much he would love to do that.
I can't successfully log in with one of those little number things.
Yes, right.
Because by the time I get the number in, it's changed, and I start from scratch, and I just, I'm not.
Ms. Tracy, are there levels of transactions, high levels of transactions, that require two signatures?
Well, all of our checks have both Eric and my signature on them. So everything.
And every account we've ever opened or closed, I've had to run over to the bank. So, you know, and I'm not bank authorizer. So.
Okay. And actually, the more exposure we have is our wire transfers, because a large quantity of our housing assistance, particularly for CAHI, is one large wire transfer at the beginning of each month. And so that has a very high level of authority that the bank requires us to set it up. And they actually put a limit on the top dollar amount. So you could, you know, and granted, it's a big dollar amount, but we are limited to $50 million per transaction. So as opposed to draining, you know, hundreds of millions, there is a limit on what we can do. And we periodically have to go back to them and increase it.
Per transaction?
Per transaction.
Jeez.
We're large.
Per day. I've actually worked at agencies that, you know, had 400 or 500 million, and it all becomes the same at the end. You're an ethical person. The size of the number doesn't tempt you. It's, you know, just getting your job done and getting the money where it needs to go.
Okay, I agree. Okay, let's pass it.
Here. Okay, let's pass it. Okay, so it's been moved.
Seconded.
All those in favor?
Aye.
Thank you, Tracy.
Any opposed? Any abstentions? Okay, it carries.
Great. Thank you, Commissioners.
So now we go to item F.
Item F, recognition of people wishing to address the commission. There are none.
We have none. So that means we move on to written communications.
In your packet, we have both monthly reports from November and December, and I'd encourage you particularly look at December. There talks a lot about our end-of-the-year activities and things that I think are really wonderful. I will mention a few of my comments, so I will save that, but we are here for any questions or comments on that. In terms of the rest of the written communications, I've included something that Commissioner Griffith, I think, probably is aware of, but it's something I found an interesting and wonderful statement that needed to be made. And I put it in the packet just so you'd be aware it's out there, mostly, if you don't have time to read it. It's called The Elephant in the Region, Charting a Path for Bay Area Metro to Lead a Bold Regional Housing Agenda. And I think there's a place on the planet that is more in need of a regional approach to housing affordability than the 9-county Bay Area.
Yep, that's right.
So I appreciated the report a lot, and please send my appreciation back to your colleagues. I thought it was really great. And there's your usual meetings and travel at the end, and that is all of my communications for this month.
Wow.
But we're available for questions if you have any. Otherwise, we'll move on to director's comments.
I have a couple.
Yes.
So, is it my turn?
Yes, it's your turn.
On page 20, concerning the owner incentives program.
This December or November?
In the first one.
Okay.
I think it's the first one. I want you to know that I'm really excited about all these programs. I know that they're doing really good thing. It's going to create a really great impact. It's just I've always been impressed that this position has the responsibility for fiscal management of the housing authority. So when I ask these questions, it's because that weighs on my shoulders. And so I know that it's an incredible, unique opportunity. And we just had a press conference about this too. But I want to make sure that there's some kind of understanding of how much we're going to spend under the owner incentive programs, because 17 owners, 24,000 for 17 owners. That's a lot to me, but mm-hmm. I'm sitting at here.
Yeah, it's reasonable. There are two things to remember in this. One is that we budgeted for the full year, so it is in the budget this year.
And how much did we budget?
I'm not sure the total amount. 500,000, I think.
500,000?
Actually, I think this year it was a million.
For all of
them. Yeah, for all of them.
For all incentives.
That makes sense, and they're broken down.
Okay.
It does cost money. The other thing I would tell you is that every month we don't have a HAP being used costs money.
Okay.
So it's a trade-off. We got tons of calls after the press, and people were wondering, how did you do it? Well, you do it using MTW fungibility. But it seems to me that a regular housing authority could probably get a waiver from HUD on a couple of things to allow them to do a couple of these initiatives. Vacancy loss, why would you lose a family who can't find, if you can keep a unit in the program, mm-hmm. and that costs you $1,600 and half this month, then why wouldn't you do that? Because otherwise you're going to have someone out searching for 6 months. And in a normal housing authority, that money then evaporates.
Okay.
You'll never get it back. It'll be year-end reconciliation. HUD will take it. It's unused. So those are all investments in the program, not just the family, preserving the private market. But it is a really good question. And we will, in the budget cycle, talk again about what it costs and how we budget it. But this was all included in last year's budget.
True.
And every one of these measures does come with with money. In December of 2017, OHA paid $2,106 in vacancy loss to two owners. So we paid basically $1,000 to two owners to keep a unit on the program.
And that value is good. That value is very good.
And then, and it goes on. But there is cost to it. And I think, and all you can say is the cost if we don't do it is we don't have people housed.
Oh, yeah. But believe me, when I ask this question, it's like, mm-hmm. do we understand this bubble?
Yeah.
And is it going to expand to a place where...
And I'll tell you how we came up with some of the estimates. For the number of people vacating in terms of the building bridges, it's the number of people that are in their programs now. So we mm-hmm. took that, figured out the average housing assistance, and then extrapolated forward.
And we have the little loans that we're going to help owners with.
Now that's an easy one.
Right.
Because we're going to get that money back in 6 months.
Because they're paying us back.
We're going to deduct it from the HAP.
Oh, okay. Good. I just need to know that someone is considering that, and I know that you guys are. So my other concern is on page 19 on the flip side of that, mm-hmm. is that it looks like we're having a lot of no-shows in our OP wait list and deep in the East portfolios, and I was just wondering how you guys are feeling about that and if there's any way to kind of help our families get here.
Yeah. Michelle Hassan will come up. She's done a couple of incredible days of this and can talk about
Michelle Hassan, Leased Housing Department. So thank you for the question. It has been difficult. Mm-hmm. We give families many, many chances.
True.
We do an initial appointment. We call them before the appointment to make sure that they're coming. We then schedule a second appointment to get the family in. And before we actually formally deny admission, we try to contact them again. So we do go out of our normal protocol. Our admin plan says after two bites at the apple, deny admission.
This is a significant difference in scheduling and showing those. Mm-hmm. So the 40 families, you've actually made contact,
yeah,
or were you just not able to reach?
So the attempt is made. So we mail the appointment letter.
Okay.
If we have an email, we will email them. Mm-hmm. If they have a phone number, we will leave a message. Some families actually say they're coming, and then they don't show up.
Okay.
So just so you know, the denial of admission also is where a family has applied for a three-bedroom unit, which is OPI, but they come to the appointment with one person. So the family size at the time of intake doesn't meet the occupancy standard.
And at that time, what happens?
So what will happen is we have a dialogue with them. Sometimes maybe they're expecting other family members to come, but they didn't show up.
Mm-hmm.
But we have a dialogue that at this time it's 5 to 8 persons
for 3 bedrooms.
For a 3 bedroom. So what we expect is that when families see an open wait list, they're putting their name on the wait list.
Well, yeah.
And you know, hoping that something may change. Also, families' composition changes over time.
True.
The children move out. They're not minors anymore. Mm-hmm. So we're having a lot of
dialogue. We also have had families that apply and then based on family members who really don't want to live with them and they won't go through the eligibility.
Right. Oh. They don't want to turn the income
in. They list
in.
Them as yeah. being possible. And, you know, it gets back. We met with, by the way, everyone home talking about the 5-year plan that they have out.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll be getting, that they're going to put out comments, and I really think it's worth looking. But one of our comments to Elaine was that they should really look at the wait lists of all the public housing authorities, affordable housing, and make sure we're building units that match the wait lists.
Yeah, we've talked about that for years.
We have a huge disconnect in this agency because they built these units based on what they thought people needed in 1950, and families have shrunk. And every single time we have opened a wait list, we are deluged by single-head household looking for an apartment.
I agree. Yeah. It would be interesting to have a conversation about opening some of these apartment buildings with the 3 bedrooms to nonprofits for, you know, permanent supportive housing. That would be very interesting. That could actually help our unhoused community, too. My last question, I think that my commissioner has a question. It doesn't say how many are on the waiting list right now, so are we running out of folks to call?
For OPI, for the wait list we just opened, 9 and 10, we have a sufficient number of families. However, for 11, 12, 13, and 14, those wait lists do need to be opened this spring.
Spring?
We've got
but this
to.
Is
wow.
This is for OPI 3-bedroom families.
3-bedroom.
4-bedroom
families.
We've
done that last year then, right?
No, we do. And that's the challenge of leasing these units, is that don't match the need.
I got you. Mm-hmm. I think Ms. Lynette has a question. Then I'll ask a question after that.
Why don't you go ahead and...
No, because it's on a different subject. So if it's about this, you can go.
It went out of my head.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Ms. Michelle. And thank you for all the work that you do. There was... I was looking under the development projects that we have, which is located at the end of the report. I was looking for Estrella Vista. And the reason I was looking for it...
Estrella Vista.
Exactly. That's what I said. And the reason I was looking for it, because they have our logo on their development board on the edge of San Pablo Avenue. You go under San Pablo...
That's a joint project. We have awarded project-based Section 8 to that unit. I didn't know the name of it. I'm sorry. it's done by Resources for Community Development.
Okay.
It was... And I would tell you that I... You know, I'm... Or am I wrong? It's... is it Mary Murtaugh or is it RCD?
It's
Yeah, it's Mary. I'm sorry. It's EAH, Mary Murtaugh, who we did Cathedral Gardens with.
Okay.
It straddles both Emeryville and Oakland.
Right.
We awarded project-based vouchers. During the process, they wanted to increase it to, and we had to figure out which unit was in what city. It was a very rough, at the 11th hour, because tax credits weren't actually generating the income.
Did it go through our board?
Yeah, absolutely. It was here with the address. They hadn't named it yet.
Gotcha.
So we have project-based in there, and it's sweet of them to put us on the billboard. They didn't have to.
How many do you remember, Eric?
I don't remember. Do you remember for that project?
Yeah. Is it senior or family?
One, two, and three bedrooms.
Okay. Well, that's exciting. That's
great
right
location.
There.
I'm grateful they got in the ground and that they're building it. Yeah.
Yes, yes, yes. The other thing is, and this is the last thing, is this connected? I don't know. I'm not sure. But I went to a neighborhood meeting. I guess it's under development and jobs. And I hear that we're putting up, if they get it, a hotel right behind Target. It's like a six-story hotel that's going up.
They're in the
up.
Planning process, yeah.
Oh, you know about it.
Well,
you
I read it. I read it in the Eric. Business news or
I
something.
I was trying to, like, give you something you didn't know about. But, you know, it's incredible. I don't know if we need another hotel.
I don't know. There are two hotels right around it.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's called
It's hotel over where Best Buy Target is over off.
Yes, 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 yes. So I wanted to give a jump to our family and community partnerships so that they can get in there. The architect,
I think that's a great suggestion. Figure out who that developer is.
Yeah, the architect said, it's not in writing, that they want to hire West Oakland residents and Oakland residents. So hire in the building of it, but also in supporting inside of the hotel. So
no, the permanent jobs at the end are great.
Yeah, so I'll give this to community.
That's great, yes.
I will
have us follow up with whoever that.
Thank you.
Whatever building it.
Very good. Good stuff.
I do have a couple of questions. I really appreciate the detail in the written reports. There's a lot of information, and it's really great to see that our residents are getting jobs. In regards to the carpenter and laborers, where it says work location and it says local, are they assigned to that local for being sent out, or are they actually working there?
They're actually in the hall. That's where they're assigned to be dispatched.
Okay. Yeah. So they're waiting for an assignment.
Yeah. I'm sure we'd appreciate the union if they would hire them as a union rep. That's actually to work.
Right.
In apprenticeship.
And then it's great to see that the occupancy rates are going up.
Mm-hmm.
Overall, and you know, with some of them it's really 100% or 99%. But I was wondering with Fruitvale and Deep East.
Mm-hmm.
So I did note that there's a fair amount of units in renovation,
mm-hmm.
but just wondering what the hang-ups might be for getting those filled.
Part of it is we had the discussion about who's coming in when they call them in for those portfolios, and also
right.
the opening of the list. We were timing actually moving from north to east for various reasons that staff thought that would be the best approach. But we are getting our leasability up in OP. The hardest to lease ones are actually AMP 9 and 10, which are East and Deep East. And those are being opened last in a way because people will reject them if there's other units and they have some challenges.
Is it because of neighborhood location?
Yes. And I think inaccessibility in terms of transportation and some other things that go on compared to other places. Our most stable, though, neighborhoods are really AMP. Around San Antonio and the Fruitvale. Some people would assume they're North Oakland, and they're not. It's that neighborhood just on the other side of the lake, really from the lake over to kind of 50th Street is the stablest place for our families in terms of the OP portfolio.
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm. And easy to lease.
So it is surprising to see that Fruitvale units are at 90%, but I see that there's a fair number in rehab.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, and that portfolio will always be in rehab because as soon as we finish it, we will start again. It's 1,500 units of scattered throughout the city, and I've just come to the acceptance that by the time we get through all the units, it's time to start again. And these are not routine flips. These are where we're going to pull out the cabinets. We're going to do some. These are major rehabs, and they go over, and most of them are done by capital improvements. The OP sites have taken on some because we want to catch up, but we've really caught up, and we've caught up to a point where the ones you're looking at. 3 years ago, there were probably twice as many in flux. And we're getting close to where we're going to take families from unrehabbed units, occupied, and move them on into a newly rehabbed unit so that we can rehab the one that they left. And that'll be, I think, a big threshold in the rehabbing this whole portfolio. When we're done with people routinely moving out and then upgrading those units, we're going to be able to upgrade people who are currently in old units, haven't ever been touched in years and years and years and years, move them into a new unit and rehab their unit. It does require moving them. Some people will not like that, but we'll work through all that. And it's definitely, I think, the threshold we want to cross soon.
Yes, we do. Thank you.
But I would also just want to add, because Mark's here and it's our first meeting of the year, and he does not only OPI, he does public housing along with the contract public housing through asset management. And we maintained a above 98% occupancy rate for the entire 12-month year of last year, which is rather an astounding accomplishment. HUD's requirement is 97. 98 is out of control good. I don't know that you can get 100% in the public housing program. 98 is phenomenal, and I'm grateful to Mark and his team, but also to the contract providers.
Well, it's hard to get 100 in anything.
Unless you're a senior building and nobody moves. But 98, and it's above 98, is phenomenal.
I'm curious, how long is the interval between from rehab to rehab?
It depends whether or not it's a routine flip, which we call routine. You go and you paint, you clean it up, and you rent it again. That's quick. That doesn't take much.
I mean a major. You do a major. A major, how many years think, before the next major?
Well, I would like, assuming it doesn't get trashed, assuming it gets taken care of, then it can be 10 years to 15 years. But you'll still flip the carpets. That'll be a routine stuff, so it should be routine. Sometimes we do have, you know, we have families in units that can have kids and everything, and they can be very, very, very hard on units. And we'll go in there, and the cabinets that we put in 5 years ago are just destroyed and need to be replaced. So we have some, our units get used. Senior units can be much easier to deal with. They don't get as heavily trampled and running around. We also have gotten better with our finishes, but you know, the carpet is like once every 7 years is the average, and painting can be once every five or more. So assuming when they come vacant, they'd be those routine flips. When we really need to get in and do plumbing and complete bathroom remodels and kitchen remodels, should be 10 or 15 years. Assuming that we have gentle tenants.
You have a question?
Yeah. No, I just wanted to give a shout out to committed to the partnership for the ambassador program.
Yes.
I mean, it's a very extensive report. It's very good. Yeah. Could you come up and just, because I see where you did the training program. Just to take a few minutes. I think education is a wonderful thing in our schools because of the dropouts of the kids that, you know, need
of
tutoring.
Course.
And I think it's, I really think that we really, you know, should place emphasis on that because, you know, it's a very good program.
Good evening, commissioners. I'm Lenita Wheeler, the Director of Family and Community Partnerships. If I'm not mistaken, you're referring to the November monthly report? Okay. We held a core Communities of Oakland Respond to Emergencies training. It's an emergency response training for our residents. We had the ambassadors participate. We also had it open to other residents who wanted to attend as well. We are increasing our focus on having a more comprehensive professional development program for our ambassadors. We have made some retooling changes for the ambassador program, one of which is changing their name from parent ambassador to education ambassador. It some people were thinking they had to be a parent or a parent of a student attending one of our partner schools, and we weren't having as many people throw their hat in the ring to participate. Some feedback we received with changing the name to education ambassador would make it more broad to where other individuals felt that they wanted to support. Another change we made was having the ambassadors move from a one school year commitment to a two school year commitment. We've learned that in order to have effective parent engagement and really assimilating into the school culture, one school year is not enough time, especially because the ambassadors typically do not begin their work at the school site until October, the first week. Even though school typically starts the last week of August, it's very common for the first 4 to 6 weeks of the school year for the school to still be in a lot of flux. They're stabilizing their enrollment, they're stabilizing their staff, and it's over the years we've learned that it's not the best time to have our ambassadors start. We wait till they're a little more settled at the school site. And so because of the decision to have the two-year commitment, a minimum for the ambassadors, we have looked at how we're providing their training. So some standard training that always occurs for them, what is chronic absenteeism, what are attendance policies, what is mandated reporting on the school site, a lot of school site policies. We are also spreading out that training throughout the 2 years to include other professional development, not just for them to use at the school site, but perhaps in their personal lives as well, because many of them are families and parents. The emergency trainings, the financial literacies, even reviewing of data and Excel sheets, and you know, what does that mean? So we've taken a concerted effort with really increasing the training and professional development of our ambassadors, given that they're committing to the minimum 2 years with us. We're also doing that because, as you know, we tend to have somewhat high turnover with our ambassador program, because oftentimes they'll get hired on by the district in full-time salaried, benefited positions in similar aspects, not always in the classroom. One individual went on to become like a bookkeeper in the nutrition department. And so we're also looking to help stabilize a bit of that for us. And so we've had the core training as well as the, we participate in a number of collaboratives. One of them is called House Ed. It's, you'll see they spelled it uniquely with a capital E in the middle. It stands for Housing and Education. There are a number of organizations who have recognized the importance and the unique opportunity that public housing authorities have, or even low-income housing providers have, with supporting their residents with education. And so we're part of a collaborative that brings together both housing providers as well as education providers to talk about the opportunities we have as housing providers in supporting the families through education. And this particular training on early November, we invited ambassadors to attend to provide resident perspective to this new initiative. So House Ed has a number of, I'll say, committees, if you would. And this one particular committee is on chronic absence. And so we had two ambassadors attend that, along with two of our FCP staff persons, myself and Sean Johnson. I just remember that one because I remember it was a compressed work schedule Friday. We also partner closely with Attendance Works. So Attendance Works is a national organization. They have loosely an office here in San Francisco, a number of staff members that work there, and they come regularly and also provide professional development to our ambassadors. And that's the trainings that we had. I'm certain that we have scheduled for future trainings to continue throughout the years. And then you have a brief overview where we've added to your monthly report a little bit of the specific activities that are taking place at each site. So you would generally get a broad overview of how many individuals had maybe enrolled in our achievement project. And this is a little very truncated what's taking place at each of the school sites that our partners are.
Amazing work.
Thank you.
I'm sure they appreciate that the education of that makes it professional. Very good.
Okay.
Yeah.
Very good.
All right. Moving on to comments, or do we have...
Okay, yeah.
I have a few comments and a few things I just want to mention. First, I just want to introduce Richard Lopato, who's our new staff attorney for OPO. Welcome aboard, Richard. Glad you're here. There are a couple things I want to mention. First, the shutdown. I'm not sure if the shutdown has been relieved because I haven't had a chance to look at the news to see if they passed the temporary resolution. I assume they did. It looked good. Both the House and the Senate.
I saw it. Yeah.
I'm grateful they did, and I guess they have, what, until February 9th?
8th.
So because of that, I wanted to still go ahead and tell you a couple things on this agency and what we do in a shutdown so you know that what we have planned. To start with, I understand with this shutdown, that they during the last well let's go let's start at the beginning. A shutdown means that it is strictly illegal for any government official to make payments or enter into contracts in excess of congressional appropriations. That requires the federal shutdown, and that actually is part of the federal code. It was last shut down, as you remember, on October of 2013, where it was shut down for 16 days. The longest shutdown was 21 days in 1995-6. So it has gone on for 3 weeks in terms of a shutdown, which is important. Because as we know, when they shut down, we need money wired to us on the first of the month to make HAP payments. So how we go about doing that is a couple of things. One of the things that happens when the government shuts down is federal agencies have to list and have a plan in which they designate certain funds as being emergency kind of funds, essential funds for government. Those will continue to flow. And I think I may have shared with you that in 2013, they put that request in, and it was granted by OMB, who said, yeah, these are essential funds and should be wired. And everyone at HUD was sent home, and there was no one who could release the funds.
Oh, bad.
So this year, I just want to report that they have resolved that, the lock system for Section 8 tenant-based rental assistance, noting that funds are only available for payment through December, obligating HAP funds, HUD-held reserves are available to draw, essential personnel at FMC, Federal Management Center, Financial Management Center, in Kansas City will be available to assist. So there's progress. Someone in Kansas is going to be there to send us some money that we have available. But what I really wanted to just mention to you, in the event that we had a shutdown and we have no, as you know, HUD holds our reserves on the OHA side. So we would, if we did not, locally for the Oakland families, if we did not have funding to cover their housing assistance payment, then I may require us to have both an emergency meeting of the Oakland Housing Authority Board of Directors and the OPI Board of Directors, at which point I may seek approval of a loan from OPI to OHA to pay the housing assistance for that month.
And what about the regional?
I can't help that.
Oh, my God.
What I can do is tell you that we would be the only housing authority in the 9-county area that is able to make their HAP payment. And only by doing this loan agreement. And I'm not sure if it would require a loan or what because of the way we've structured the OPI and the money that initially went in. But there is that. So I just was a little less, I'm not concerned that this is going to go on, but from February 9th to March 1st. But I did want you to know that we have a plan and that we know how we're going to do this, and at least for our families in Oakland.
Thank you.
And any other questions, let me know about the shutdown. I probably have no meaningful answer, but I will try.
You know, Eric, it just occurred to me that that should be at least a fairly persuasive argument as to why our reserve should not be held in Washington.
We actually made that. We requested 3 months of HAP,
right.
And we were so kicked to the curb by OMB, GAO, HUD, and OIG. I think what they've done is ridiculous. I think at least 1 month is reasonable. And we went in with three thinking we would get one, and we got nothing. So.
That's amazing.
And that was the former administration. I don't know. This one will probably be harder on that issue.
You never know.
Yeah, you really don't. It's a good point.
This is really...
Yeah. Yeah. So we will take this year one by one. I think it is going to be, and I've shared this with some staff members, I do think it's going to be a challenging political year for this agency and for this country. And so I'm just getting us as ready as we can be to make it to December and see where we are and move forward. A couple other things I wanted to talk about. Just so you're aware, one is we are planning right now before the board meeting in February to take pictures. We need to a couple of commissioner pictures, and we'll let you know. Also, if anybody else wants to retake their picture, we'll throw that out as well. So it'll be coming early, and we'll have the photographer here, and then we can do it before the meeting.
I finally saw your picture.
We held a mayor's press conference last Wednesday, which was enormously well attended by the press. Now, I know that they were here, and so does the mayor, to talk to her about ICE, but they sat through our presentation. The presentation was wonderful, and I really want to thank the leased housing staff and all that they did, and Greer McVeigh, who really put the whole thing together, wrote the press release and made it all happen and made everybody look great. And I particularly want to mention the three landlords who showed up and spoke, the two other landlords who were in the audience, and our own Sharon Montgomery, who got up and talked on behalf of Section 8 tenants. She did a wonderful job.
Yes.
We did get a news feed on it from pretty much everyone. I didn't see it. It was on TV. They didn't post the video. It was one of those informative things more than anything. And I was grateful that everybody wanted to know about ICE because we got our word out that we offer these incentives and please call us. We do have some info out there and some one page if people are asking, have them contacted. We really want, if their owners are interested, we want them to call our owner services. We want to talk to Tila Carpenter. There's not a line. We'll get back to you, we promise.
And you mentioned there was a spike in interest right after the press.
There was on Thursday. They got a lot of inquiries and a lot of inquiries from around the area and around and a lot of inquiries from other housing authorities mm-hmm. who are so struggling. Mm-hmm. So I'm very proud of that. You do have the NorCal NARO conference will be in Nampa, and there is a commissioner's track on Sunday, which should be interesting. The chair's helping and the vice chair's put it together. And Patricia Wells has been instrumental in supporting that, and I appreciate it, and I'm grateful. February 7th, I will be attending a statewide executive director meeting. It's the California Association of Housing Authorities. We get together once every 2 years and kvetch and complain, but it's a good group. They've been very helpful. They're how we organize the California MTW statewide movement. So I'm going to go talk a little bit about that. What I also wanted to mention is I've been in conversations with Senator Skinner about introducing a bill on behalf of OHA and the County of Alameda and Contra Costa, should they choose. It's to amend the California Housing and Safety Code, which regulates housing authorities, to remove a section of language that prohibits us from acquiring market rate properties. There's a big reason for doing this, and we've got the language drafted. It's in. When I get a number, hopefully before the next meeting, I'll probably do a briefing of what the proposal is. It's a pilot program specific to these counties. We know that there are several other counties who the network has gone out and they want to try and join it. But it would allow us to try. It's actually, for me, an anti-displacement measure. This is a state law that we only have. Other states don't. And in King County, Washington, they have been doing this for the past 2 to 3 years to avoid displacement. They buy a property, they don't displace anybody, they use private financing, they manage it responsibly, and they don't raise rents. California Civil Code prevents us from doing that. The reason was, in the 1930s and 40s, there was a very large developer-landlord lobby who were very nervous about the creation of housing authorities, and they wanted to restrict their ability to acquire and develop market-rate housing. I think looking historically back, that might have been what it took, but now I think it's regrettable in that we haven't been able to compete with the private market and we have a state that is overwhelmingly unaffordable. Along those lines, I'm going to read you part of what I read at the press conference because I think it's important that the total, and this is from a Zillow report, the total value of the housing market is 1.5 times greater than the U.S. gross domestic product, and almost three times that of China. The 1.95 trillion increase surpasses Canadians' gross national product, or two firms the size of Apple. Rent prices escalated nationally, with renters spending a record $485 billion in 2017, an increase of $4.9 billion from 2016. Wages have not gone up a penny.
True.
The real estate value is so out of whack when you compare it to the ability to pay and the incomes of this country that we're on a path that I can't even begin to think. And you couple that with a stock market that is rapidly increasing solely based on the fact they're going to get $1.5 trillion worth of tax credits, not because they're doing any selling more, mm-hmm. not because they're performing better, or not because they're employing people. It's a scariest path I think we've ever been on. This is an opportunity, should Senator Skinner proceed, and it looks like she will, and we have support from all the housing authorities in both counties who want this bill. So, doing a pilot is an easier lift because there'll be places in this state that don't necessarily want it. The pilot would allow us then to seek private capital, meaning a line of credit from a bank, and acquire properties at market rate, and we will manage them based on what their expenses are rather than trying to exploit every dollar from every resident. That's the basic provision. With us, it will also allow us to, because we'll have no intent to make them affordable, we won't have to pay more than appraised value, and we don't have to go through the NEPA process. And the challenge you have when you're a housing authority trying to acquire land in an escalating market is you have to go through NEPA to use any of your traditional funding sources. NEPA will require 3 months. You can't pay more than appraised value, so if you enter into an agreement now, in 3 months it's going to be worth more because the market's escalated. But secondly, you can't negotiate the price of a property. It's what an appraiser says. And that can be very, very limiting, if not impossible, when you deal with our kind of rental market. So it will improve, I think, our footprint. It can really help with displacement, and we can maybe make some dents in some properties as they become available. So I'll give a longer report once the bills, and I'll give you a copy of the language and what the proposal is. But I am grateful for the senator for being willing to carry this, and been working with her closely since December to get this kind of launched.
So when you get a one-pager together, I'd like to incorporate that into my state advocacy efforts.
That would be great.
Okay. Maybe on Housing California's
platform. Hopefully we'll have everything assigned by the time I hit that CAHA conference, because I do think it's powerful if other large areas who are suffering this call her office and say, I want to sign on. And can we be part of the pilot? And I don't want to in any way deny anyone the ability to do this in the state. I think we all should be doing it. And we'll see how it goes. A couple other things, we had the toy drive, and we had the toy giveaway, which was actually much more than that. It was quite a wonderful thing. If you've never attended, we were able to double the number of children who received toys to 1,200 this year based on donations from the foundation. We did it in a very short period of time because it was during a school day. So they came after 2 o'clock, and we were done by 4:30 to 5:30.
Wow.
They all got to see Santa and do a lot of engagement. Family community partnerships got to speak with everyone as they were enrolling and talk to them. And it's all building a bridge not only for the police department but also for our service at, family community partnerships, so that they can more target resources toward families. These are really families that are identified by OHA as being the most in need. And we're grateful to be able to do that. I also want to let you know that the Kaiser Permanente Foundation gave us a $20,000 donation toward the toy drive because they recognize this kind of activity is how you're successful year-round in trying to reach and build trust with different families. I think it's the first major donation the foundation's ever got from a corporate foundation. And I would tell you, we didn't approach it. They approached us. And said, what do you guys need? And I said, I need toys for my toy giveaway because we only have enough for 600, and we've got twice, and we ended up doing 1,200. And they got us a check in pretty much 24 hours. They had the grant approved.
Did we do it at 935 or in East Oakland?
We did it at the service center inside so that the weather isn't
good.
Yeah, and also so we can control and make sure we can control the crowds. But I am grateful. I'm grateful for the foundation and all the staff work. It's a lot of work to do. The police department really rolls out the red carpet and opens up their space and their hearts to the kids and the families, and it's terrific to see. This year we will be having a separate process for looking at, from the board level and also public input, for both the admin plan and the ACOP, the Public Housing Application Continuing Occupancy Plan. We broke it off because there's a lot of rewriting we want to do and consolidating the two into one document. So what I have asked the chair is to appoint an ad hoc committee, an administrative plan ad hoc committee, to go chapter by chapter, get some feedback and input. They will then, we'll put it out for public comment. They'll host a public hearing and hopefully come back to the board sometime in the summer, really, with a document that is really thoughtful and rather than pieced together like we've done for a lot of years. It's really some fairly time-consuming policy work, so do consider that when you talk to the chair about participating. It's going to take, similar to the special needs, it's going to be an ongoing effort for the rest of the year to really try and get this right. It's a complicated mix between what we have to do, what we can do, and what we can get MTW authorities to do. Staff have been working on this chapter by chapter over the past 6 months, and they're getting ready to come forward with what they think are changes, talk about policy questions, and get some input from the board. And I think the ad hoc committee is the best way to do that because they can sit down and go page by page. But it's interesting work. It's, you can really, you know, impact policy through that discussion. The MTW plan is being finalized. It'll be put out for public comment. We will hold our public hearing in February's meeting and have a presentation like we do annually, but it will just be the MTW plan, not the admin plan and not the ACOP, because we want to take a closer look at those to see what ideas we can come up with. Also, the fiscal year 2019 budget is being created by staff. We will do it the same way we had last year. We'll have a budget meeting early May where we just talk about the budget and no action, and then we can come back in May and talk further about the budget before it goes for approval. I think that's, if there's any other way you want to treat it, please talk it over with the chair. But we have, you know, we have now an experienced board around the table. There's not new members, and we can, I think we can really cover the whole thing in one evening and get a lot of input, and then we'll come back with the final. And the budget.
I think it went well last year.
The what?
It went well last
year.
I
thought it was, I really enjoyed that meeting.
I mean, I think we should let, if anybody has any issues with that, let me know.
This was the one where the projects were spotlighted.
Yep, we go.
And I just wanted them to also add the budget piece right into the.
How much each costs, yeah.
Thank you, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. And this year we are proposing, in a little heads up, to increase the amount of investment in economic development for our residents, job training, placement, and creating an in-house division to do that. We're doing that not in small part to limits of our partners in those areas in terms of serving our residents and outcomes.
Okay.
So we want to have more control over the employers and hosting our own. And I would tell you in Jobs Plus, we've learned a lot in working with our partners, and we've been much more successful at placements than some of the partners who are working with us. And so we really want to try and see if we can make that real. It is a statutory requirement of MTW, and I think we're underinvested in it. We do the apprentice program, we have family community partnerships, but I think we need to really take another look, and there isn't really someone to contract with. Mm-hmm. So that's going to be part of the pitch this year, is to create that as a project. And that's my report.
Thank you.
Happy 2018. It's been a fun month, huh?
Happy 2018, indeed. All right. So that means we go on to item 9, which is reports.
We missed. Oh, good. I get it. That's the one.
Yeah, commission committee.
We didn't have any.
I don't think we had any meeting. And we're going to have a short closed session at the end, and
okay.
It will be very short.
Thank you.
Let's see, we have announcements by commissioners now, so if anyone has any, no?
Okay.
Yes. Okay, good. So in that case, we just need a motion to adjourn to closed session. Okay, and Do you want to take, I mean, closed session will literally be like 5 minutes probably, so if you, or if you want to take a 5-minute break, we're good. Okay, cool.